Greetings and mentatious revelations, my hyperbolically itinerant listeners, and welcome to this April 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this all exceedingly protonaceous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, I'm going to start this segment with a technological death knell. Some pieces of technology simply fade away slowly, and others are rushed to their deaths on high-speed trams. Compact discs seem to be moving into the horizon at some speed in between. CDs have been around since the late 1980s. I actually remember the first time I bought a CD because A, it was in an unusual place, an RCA Columbia warehouse in Jacksonville, Illinois, and B, because the CD that I got was such a fantastic bargain, even though I didn't actually have a CD player at the time. I had quite an eclectic vinyl record collection at the time, and remember thinking what a pain in the neck it was to move that collection around every time I moved from one place to another. I was at a temporary teaching post at a little college in the middle of Illinois, and soon would be heading off to a doctoral program hundreds of miles away. Thought of moving those records again was less than pleasant. I remember thinking at the time that if I bought this awesome new CD collection of the Well-Tempered Clavier, then I could lighten my load of vinyl records just a little bit. And little did I know that I would begin a future in which I would not only be carrying all my old records, I would now be transporting all my new CDs as well. Well, tonight I come to tell you that CDs are going the way of the buggy whip, cassette tapes, wired telephones, and Lindsay Lohan. Last weekend I went searching at several electronic stores, which I will not advertise for here. I was looking for a clock radio with a CD player for my soon-to-be 6-year-old son. At the first store I stopped in, I found, yes, one clock radio with a CD player. It had minimal options, tinny sound, and was made by an off-brand company I had never heard of before. However, there were at least a dozen choice models of clock radio which had built-in ports for iPods. Okay, I thought, I'll try one of the bigger electronic warehouse places. Well, the bigger place had two choices. Another lousy quality off-brand clock radio with a CD player, and a pink Hello Kitty clock radio. I knew my son was not going for the Hello Kitty clock radio, so I was stuck. I called my lovely wife for advice. She suggested, since I was nearby, that I should try the Goodwill store. She figured that lots of people would be donating old clock radios with CD players for tax write-offs, especially at this time of year. She was wrong. Not only was there not a clock radio with a CD player, there were no clock radios at all at the secondhand store. I have concluded that the death of CDs will be here soon, that we will soon be expected to go entirely digital and download our music from iTunes and other sources. Frankly, I'm not sure whether this is a good thing, but things are changing whether we like it or not. The one thing technology is bound to do is change. New 2014 car models still have CD players, along with radios as a standard feature. The radios aren't going anywhere because radio programs and music are still out there and mostly free, but it may not be very long before you will no longer be able to get a CD player in your car, just as you can no longer get a cassette player. For you youngsters out there, ask your parents what I'm talking about. My son picked up an old cassette tape I had in a box in the garage the other day and asked what the heck it was. When I explained to him what it was for, I felt older than I have in a while. Okay, let's get going on to actual science here before I start blubbering. Those were the days, my friend. Okay, the first science story of the night just kind of annoyed me, and you'll know why in a moment. You would think that after thousands of years of eating food, humans would have some clue as to what is good for you and what is not. But even after all this time, we are still arguing. I was annoyed by this story because I thought that nutritionists had finally come to a logical conclusion. But apparently nutrition and logic don't necessarily go together. In two independent studies, people and mice eating diets low in protein were healthier and tended to live longer than those eating protein-rich diets. Both those studies can be found in the March edition of the journal Cell Metabolism and suggest that animal proteins, including those from meat and dairy, are less healthy than plant proteins. Okay, I thought we had concluded once and for all already that high protein diets are A, not harmful, and B, good for you because they bring down weight and lower cholesterol. I thought we had finally concluded in the last decade that high carb diets are bad because any extra sugar in your body gets turned into fat. Are we now back at square one? Carbs good, protein bad? Well, the answer seems to be yes and no. Let me explain. The first study comes out of the lab of Dr. Morgan Levine of USC. Levine found that out of more than 6,000 people, 50 years of age and older, those 65 and younger who got less than 10% of their calories from protein had lower risks of dying from cancer and diabetes during 18 years of follow-up than those who ate more protein. People who ate moderate amounts of protein, making up 10 to 19% of their diet, had, for instance, three times the chance of dying from cancer as those on a low-protein diet. This is what boggles my mind. Wait, less than 20% is moderate? That doesn't seem like a lot of protein to me. I mean, whose definition was that? Okay, what else? Well, here's the good news. After age 65, though, the pattern reversed with high-protein diets, 20% or more, carrying lower risks of dying of cancer. And although my wife laughingly reassured me I'm getting closer to that magic 65 mark, I still have a long, long way to go to get there, thanks. Morgan said, quote, "A high-protein diet is one of the worst things you could do up to age 65. Eating lots of protein, especially protein from animal sources, can be nearly as harmful to health as smoking," unquote. Great to know. I've been killing myself the last few years with lean chicken breasts. What about the other study? Well, the second study comes out of the lab of Dr. Samantha Solenbiet of the University of Sydney. She found that protein proved more important than calories for determining health and longevity. Researchers fed 858 mice one of 25 diets that had varying ratios of proteins, carbohydrates, fats, and calories. Those that ate low-protein, high-carbohydrate diets fared the best. As the protein content climbed, though, the mice's risk of dying younger also seemed to increase. In contrast, however, dropping calories without lowering protein generally did not affect the rodents' lifespans. That result seems to contradict previous studies that have shown that cutting calories lengthens lifespan in organisms, including yeast, fruit flies, dogs, and mice. Solenbiet says, quote, "The study may shed light on how caloric restriction actually extends life. We think that calorie restriction works not by restricting the amount of energy, but by restricting protein," unquote. This, by the way, is an entirely new view on life extension. It had been thought up to this point that life extension by caloric restriction assumed you were just cutting down on everything. Apparently, it may not be that simple. Maybe it's the proteins that are the real problem and not the rest of our diet. In Solenbiet's study, mice eating low-protein, carb-rich diets had lower activity in a gene called mTOR in their livers than mice on protein-rich diets did. And her previous studies have shown that reduced activity of mTOR usually predicts better health and longer lives in mice. She found that not only did high-protein diets cause an increase in mTOR activity, but mice also on low-protein, high-fat diets were less healthy and died younger. So let me get this straight. Too much protein, you die young. Too much fat, you die young. A carb-rich diet with low protein, and you'll outlive Lazarus Long. Why am I just a teeny bit worried here for those of us who still are well below retirement age and love our bacon? Is there any hope for protein lovers? Well, Solenbiet says, quote, "If your body can sustain protein restrictions, adults should try it. However, if you still want higher levels of protein in your diet, there's no downside to replacing meat with plant proteins such as those found in beans and nuts. If we're wrong, there's no negative side effects. If we're right, it means a reduction in cancer and diabetes," unquote. Great. Whoopee. Soy burgers, here I come. Yeah, yeah, I can hear you vegetarians out there laughing your behinds off. Tee hee hee hee. I now have several physical science stories that have caught the attention of the international science community. The first of those stories is probably the most important. In fact, some science commentators are suggesting that this is probably the most important science story of the year so far. So important, it was even mentioned in a TV comedy program last week, The Big Bang Theory, oddly enough. What is the story? Well, there's now strong evidence that the universe is truly in an expanding state. This may not mean much to the common folk, but it does support the theory of a Big Bang followed by continuous growth of the universe outward, as opposed to a static, ungrowing universe. A group of astronomers led by Dr. John Kovac of Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics measured subtle variations in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background using the BICEP 2 telescope. The BICEP telescope is located in Antarctica and houses 512 detectors, each cooled to nearly 1/4 degree Celsius above absolute zero. I guess the keeping them on ice down there under helps to cool them all that cheaper. Anyway, the detectors alternate, half filtering out horizontally aligned light and half vertical light. By regularly scanning a region of the sky above the South Pole, the researchers were able to map a chunk of the cosmic microwave background with polarized light. I'll explain in a second why polarized light waves are so important here, at least as far as I understand. They released the results in papers posted online. And by the way, that makes me a little bit nervous because they have not submitted their results to an actual journal yet. Anyway, better informed physicists than me seem very excited over this, so for once I will not judge the quality of the science. Astronomers have predicted that cosmic inflation, if it occurred, would have left marks on the cosmic microwave background radiation. The flash of light released into space about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe had cooled down enough for light to actually travel freely. They've suggested that one signature of that inflation would be found in how photons align and polarize. Gravitational ripples induced by inflation would have set up swirling patterns in that light polarization. Astrophysicists call this special swirling of photon energy B-mode polarization. And up until now, this has been exceedingly hard to detect. But detection of B-mode polarization of light waves in the cosmos would strengthen the case for universal inflation, mainly because primordial gravitational waves are the only known source that physicists can think of. Well, to sum it up, Kovacs and his team have actually detected this so-called B-mode polarization of light, indicating strong gravitational waves. In fact, the strength of the gravitational waves was much higher than Kovacs' group had expected. The surprisingly strong signal rules out several possible other models for cosmic inflation. Kovac says, quote, "This opens up a whole new window, a whole new research area. The high energies seen in the inflationary epoch make it possible to test some ideas from string theory, which many assumed were not testable. This is a playground for everyone to start testing their theories," unquote. Kovac goes on to say that although he is hugely excited by his findings, as with all science, we need to be careful until all the data is in. Quote, "It's not a fluke, that's for sure, but we don't know for certain if the signal is really from the early universe or if it's an artifact from the telescope, or even intervening galaxies. At least 8 other telescopes are now looking for B-mode polarization. Their findings will help nail down the source of the signal and perhaps support our own findings," unquote. Staying in space, it was reported in the journal Science in the April 4th issue that the interior structure of Saturn's moon Enceladus may be one of the most interesting and promising places for life in the whole solar system. Dr. Luciano Ies of the University of Rome and his team have for the first time measured the depth and extent of a subsurface sea on the ice-covered moon of Enceladus. The findings further support the notion that an underground reservoir feeds the moon's ice geysers and raises questions about Enceladus's habitability. For a long time, astronomers thought the 500-kilometer-wide Enceladus was a dead world, but the Cassini spacecraft in 2004 found an active moon, with geysers shooting particles of salty water through fissures that dot the southern hemisphere. The fissures expand and contract in rhythm with the tides of Saturn. It was thought that vast amounts of water lurked under that surface, but that water has been hypothetical up until now. To peek inside Enceladus, ES used Doppler shifts in the Cassini spacecraft's earthbound radio signal during 3 flybys of the moon. The Doppler shifts, tiny changes in the frequency of the radio waves as it moved, tracked the spacecraft's speed. Whenever Cassini passed over a part of the moon with slightly more mass, the increased gravity accelerated the probe. ES used the changes in Cassini's speed to map Enceladus's interior structure. Okay, I'm not a physical scientist, but that is very imaginative and very cool. ES's team concluded that a 10-kilometer-deep ocean must sit under 30 to 40 kilometers of ice and on top of the moon's rocky core. Extending from the South Pole to mid-southern latitudes, the sea has a volume of water similar to Lake Superior's. ES expected the result and says, quote, "I would have been more surprised if we didn't find anything," unquote. One thing that is not yet clear is how that sea feeds the ice geysers tens of kilometers above it to the surface. ES says, quote, "It seems unlikely you'd have a lake directly connected to the surface. There must be an intermediate plumbing system to move all that water up and out," unquote. As far as life is concerned on the moon, ES says, "Some interesting chemistry may be going on where the sea's water meets rock. Any discussion of heat rising up from the moon's interior mixed with a salty ocean inevitably leads to musings on possible life, though no evidence suggests that aliens swim the seas of Enceladus. The presence of a warm, briny environment raises intriguing possibilities," unquote. This is all very neat stuff for anybody who's a lover of SF and wonders if there is life out there. Unfortunately, there is a sucky aspect to all of this as well. Whether there is life on Enceladus or not will remain a moot question for quite a while longer. First of all, we're obviously not going to Enceladus very soon. But the other thing is that the Cassini probe has only 2 more flybys of the moon planned. ES says, quote, "We're essentially done with Enceladus for the moment. Unfortunately, it will be a long time before we return to a very interesting moon," unquote. Tantalized by the siren song, but still bound to our earthly mast, well, still sticking to the astronomic theme of the evening, the next story is another update on the exoplanet search. Remember that exoplanets are any planet which are circling other stars out there in the universe besides old Sol here. At this point, the number of exoplanets has been raised to about 1,700. Dr. Jack Lissauer of NASA and his research group just reported online at archive.org in a better way to ensure that what we are observing out there are really planets. Lissauer's group, using the Kepler Space Telescope, have confirmed the existence of 715 new planets orbiting 305 stars. Lissauer's confirmations more than double the number of planets established by the now-crippled Kepler since 2009. In the past, the Kepler telescope was used to search for planets by looking for tiny dips in starlight that occur when a planet periodically passes in front of, or transits, as astronomers call it, its star. However, transiting planets aren't the only reason stars appear to flicker. Most commonly, the light dips can be caused by a chance alignment with an eclipsing binary. That's a pair of stars that orbit each other, and one occasionally blocks out the light from the other. Lissauer argued that several detections around a single star are not likely to be false positives. So his group calculated that eclipsing binaries would be very unlikely to cause multiple dips in a star's light. While one eclipsing binary getting in the way is possible, 2 isn't likely. 3 or 4 is nearly impossible. Because astronomers were seeing many more stars that seemed to have multiple planets than expected from random alignments with binaries, nearly all must be actual solar systems, the researchers at least reasoned. To confirm previous exoplanet candidates as real, a team spent many months with a ground-based telescope for each of those candidate planets. The 715 new planets emerged from only the first 2 years of observations, but Kepler kept observing for an additional 2 years before the second of its 4 reaction wheels failed in May 2013, making it now inaccurate for measurements. However, that does mean that Lissauer's team now has another 2 years of data to sift through. Lissauer says, quote, "We are confident that this technique will turn up hundreds of more exoplanets," unquote. Okay, we're done with astronomy. Let's go back to biology for the next story. Usually it takes months or years to find evidence of someone's misconduct in science. This particular story shows that in this modern age of instant communication, you'd better be very careful about what kind of science you're making up in your journal articles. In the very prestigious journal Nature, at the end of January, a major research story was published by Dr. Haruko Obakata of the Riken Institute, which suggested that you could dip adult cells into acid and easily make them into stem cells. This acid method of making a type of stem cell, known as STAP cells, came under fire as soon as it appeared in two papers in Nature at the end of January. Many researchers since January have tried and failed to repeat the feat. Other scientists have pointed out that some pictures in the reports appear to have been tampered with or repeated, and some passages of text are identical to parts of other publications. Now, the Riken Institute, where Obakata was based, has completed an initial examination and found that the lead researcher committed fraud by deliberately altering some of the images. Obakata said in a written statement that she received the ruling with feelings of, quote, "indignation and surprise," and that she would appeal. Riken is attempting to replicate the creation of STAP cells, but Dr. Masatoshi Taikichi, director of the Riken Center of Developmental Biology, cautioned in a statement that confirmation could take up to a year. All I can say is Obakata may be sincere and may simply be a victim of her own lousy science. By the way, I suspect, in the back of every scientist's mind constantly lurks this fear of whether they actually did their experiments with due diligence. Did they trust that undergrad a bit too much? Did that grad student misinterpret their directions or use a bit too much bias to consider the data? Did the PI themselves use a bit too much bias or the wrong method for performing or interpreting the experimental data? Was the equipment reliable? Were their statistical methods reliable and correct? We all want to be good scientists and publish good data, and we try our hardest, but it's easy to sink into paranoia, especially when you see someone like Obakata, who seems sincere in her denial. Maybe it really isn't her fault, but then again, who knows? The journal Nature has not said whether Obakata's papers will be retracted or not, as some of the co-authors have requested. The journal is conducting its own investigation. The last story of the night may make some of you uncomfortable because it has to do with body parts that make people blush. Just be aware, if you have young kids listening or are particularly sensitive, you may just want to skip this last story. In the past, I have chatted about genetic abnormalities of sexual development. Oddly enough, some of the intersexual phenomena that I told you guys about were fairly common. There are, however, a set of genetic developmental problems that occur in XX females that are even more rare and a bit disconcerting. Whenever I take up this topic in my medical genetics class, I think the students become a bit uneasy. At the very least, they don't look very comfortable. I'm talking about diseases that cause a phenomenon called vaginal dysplasia. This is a condition in which a woman with normal female chromosome karyotype 46XX is characterized by complete or partial absence of the vagina. The less rare form and less severe is called Meyer-Rokitansky syndrome, and it occurs in about 1 in 5,000 female births. Usually women affected by MR have a short or absent vaginal cavity, but they still have a uterus or ovaries, and they're simply not connected through. They are obviously infertile for that reason. The more severe form of this congenital malformation is called Meyer-Rokitansky-Custer-Hauser syndrome, or MRKH syndrome. or congenital absence of the uterus and vagina. This occurs in about 1 in 20,000 female births, and as the name implies, not only are the MRKH-affected women a bit like Barbie dolls, but they're also lacking in the rest of their reproductive apparatus. The cause for either of these diseases is still not clear, as far as I know. Several studies have shown there is no dominant genetic cause for MRKH, although there are chromosomal abnormalities. In the past, when I've spoken of treatment for these women in my classes, I have shrugged and said that the usual treatment is surgery to create a neo-vagina through the methods used most commonly on male-to-female transsexuals. Sadly, the outcome for affected women who have this surgery is ironically less effective than it would be for a transsexual because of the different tissues involved in the operations. I won't go into those details. However, April news from the medical journal The Lancet and Dr. Tony Atala's lab of Wake Forest Hospital may change all that. The title of Atala's story is, quote, Tissue-Engineered Autologous Vaginal Organs in Patients, a Pilot Cohort Study, unquote. Atala has been key in the last few years in growing functioning organs like bladders and urethras in the lab and transplanting them into patients. He has now grown a functioning vagina in his laboratory. In his new study, Atala employed several female patients who had congenital vaginal dysplasia due to MR or MRKH. The patients were ages 13 to 18 years of age. He obtained a biopsy of tissue from each patient, then cultured, expanded, and seeded epithelial and muscle cells onto biodegradable scaffolds. The organs were constructed and allowed to mature in an incubator. Then, his group surgically implanted these organs into the affected women. And this is not something Atala just did. He performed these operations 8 years ago. Now, after 8 years, the work on these women is being reported as the follow-ups are being conducted and the study is being finished. The upshot is they found no long-term post-operative surgical complications. The tissue looked absolutely normal and grew normally in every case. Atala says, quote, yearly serial biopsies showed a tri-layered structure consisting of an epithelial cell-lined lumen surrounded by matrix and muscle, with expected components of vaginal tissue present. Immunohistochemical analysis confirmed the presence of phenotypically normal smooth muscle and epithelium, unquote. Further, the women are apparently quite happy after 8 years with their new organs. Atala adds, quote, a validated self-administered female sexual function index questionnaire showed variables in the normal range in all areas tested, such as desire, arousal, lubrication, orgasm, satisfaction, and painless intercourse, unquote. Now here's the real kicker. The MR-affected women who had their ovaries and uterus present have actually undergone menses since these operations. And Atala says he is certain that they can undergo normal pregnancy with proper precautions. This is amazing. I mean, it's another breakthrough in tissue engineering and bodes well for our future of replacing human parts that are never there in the first place or get damaged during our lifetimes. As Atala concludes, quote, we are very happy with the vaginal organs that we have engineered from the patient's own cells and implanted. They have shown normal structure and function, even with a follow-up of up to 8 years. This is all very promising, and who knows what we shall be able to engineer in the next few years, unquote. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Remember to reduce that animal protein intake. Don't give up on compact discs quite yet, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.